Welcome to the Science, Microbes, and Health podcast, covering emerging topics and challenges in the fields of probiotics, prebiotics, synbiotics, postbiotics, and fermented foods. This is the podcast of the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, known as ISAP, a nonprofit scientific organization dedicated to advancing the science of these fields. Check us out at www.isapscience.org. I'm Dr. Mary Helen Sanders, ISAP's Executive Science Officer. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Dan Tancredi.
Hi, everybody. My name's Colin Hill.
And I'm Daniel Tancredi.
And today's guest is Karen Scott from the Rawat Institute in Aberdeen. So, Karen, you're very welcome.
Hi, everyone.
You will pick up, I think, as we go ahead, that Karen is from Scotland. I think it's pretty clear from your accent. And can you tell us something about the Rawat? What is the Rawat and what's the main activity of the Rawat Institute?
Okay, so the Rawat is a research institute based in Aberdeen in Scotland, as you said. And we're a human nutrition institute. So our main focus is investigating all aspects of human nutrition, in fact. And our history is, we have like 3 Nobel Prize winners from the Rawat, in fact, over the past 100 years since we were established. And during the wartime in the UK, certainly the Rawat was instrumental in making sure that rationing didn't affect the health of the nation too badly. So we sort of built on that over the years since then. We've done animal nutrition and now very much human nutrition. And we're now, in the last 10 years, we've been part of the University of Aberdeen as well.
That's really fascinating. And when did the microbiome, when did bugs become part of the sphere of interest for the Rawat?
That's a great question. So basically, we at the Rawat have been working on anaerobic bacteria from the rumen for probably about 40 years, if not longer. And then about 25 years ago in the late 1990s, we started culturing the anaerobic bacteria from the human large intestine. And we now have a culture collection of more than 1,000 different bacteria that we've isolated from the human gut. And I guess we were actually probably one of the first labs to start culturing these anaerobic bacteria from the human gut and trying to look up what function they had in the human gut, because I think at the time when we started working on them, people really still thought that a lot of the bacteria in the human gut were either aerobic and also caused disease, and not that we actually, just like ruminants, had a large population of bacteria that were really important for health.
And how did you come to work then on the topic of prebiotics? And maybe you could start by giving us almost a primer on what prebiotics actually are.
Okay, so prebiotics are compounds that help the growth of bacteria that are already in the human gut, the healthy bacteria that are already there. So when we started moving into working on human gut bacteria, which was probably my second postdoc at the Rawat, was looking at human gut bacteria, we realized that they relied on different aspects of our diet to help them to grow. But they had to be parts of the diet that would be able to reach the large intestine where most of these bacteria live. And prebiotics are one such dietary component because they're not digested by enzymes in the upper gastrointestinal tract. So they reach the large intestine and they're used by the bacteria that live there to grow. And those bacteria that live there then produce various different metabolites and other substances that are then beneficial for the health of the host, be that a human or an animal host as well.
So if we didn't have microbes in the gut, and particularly in the colon, would these prebiotics just simply pass through us? Are they always foods that are unavailable to us, or could we break them down if we really had to?
No, I think my understanding certainly is that to be a prebiotic compound has to reach the large intestine pretty well undigested by host enzymes. So whether that's human enzymes or animal enzymes, and therefore they're digested by bacteria. Some of that digestion may happen by bacteria higher up the intestinal tract. They may not all reach the large intestine as they are, but they're definitely not digested by human enzymes or animal enzymes.
Karen, I know that one of the many important works that you've authored had to do with the overall dietary influences on the health and on the gut bacteria. Am I correct in understanding that your original motivation was just to understand all the dietary influences from the macronutrients, and then you kind of then focused more on the prebiotics after you realized their key role? Or
okay, that's a great point, Dan. So yeah, I mean, I would always, when people ask me, should they take prebiotics, then I guess one of my answers is always that prebiotics should be used in addition to your normal diet. So having a healthy, regular diet is actually more crucial if you want than taking a single prebiotic, because there are so many different components in a healthy diet that can be beneficial. So yeah, you're right. We started working on how particular types of fiber pass through the intestinal tract and reach the large intestine for digestion by bacteria that live there. Because a lot of fiber that we eat as part of our normal diets, all humans eat as normal part of their normal diets, are also undigested in the upper digestive tract and reach the large intestine. And the fiber that comes in there is quantitatively, there's a lot more of that than there is of any single prebiotic. So I guess one thing I should say, which is really quite important, is that prebiotics aren't necessarily always supplements. You get prebiotics within foods. So a lot of the high fiber foods, part of that fiber content is actually prebiotics. So it's sometimes quite hard to differentiate between fiber and prebiotics in your head. And that's partly because you can't always differentiate between them, because prebiotics are a type of fiber, really.
Can you give us some examples of some foods? I think it's largely plant material, isn't it, that's very high in fiber and prebiotics?
Yeah, so cereals, fruits and vegetables are very high in fiber. And the ones that are highest in the sort of recognized prebiotics, certainly, are sort of bulb-based vegetables, so chicory, garlic, leeks. And there's also like banana and plantain contain quite a lot of prebiotic compounds as well. But if you look at the sort of bulb type vegetables, onions, garlic, leeks and chicory, you might not necessarily want to eat them in very large amounts. And that's one of the reasons that sometimes a supplement of prebiotics might be quite beneficial, because certainly I know my husband wouldn't be very happy if I ate 5 grams of garlic a day to get the, well, enough is, actually that's not even correct. He wouldn't be very happy if I ate enough garlic every day to get the 5 grams of prebiotic that's important for health, because that's the studies that have been done on prebiotics indicate that that's the sort of amount that's required. But going back to Dan's question about general healthy diet, that is really critical. Like, you should eat such a, eating a very diverse healthy diet helps to keep the diversity of all the gut microbes. So I guess that's something that I didn't really mention yet, is that not all prebiotics are equal. Different bacteria are able to degrade and utilize different types of fiber and prebiotics for growth. So if you just ate a particular prebiotic, even if it's a really good prebiotic with lots of evidence behind it, if that was all you actually ate, then, well, one, that would be pretty impossible. But the second fact would be that that would really encourage growth of a particular group of bacteria, but it wouldn't do anything for lots of other bacteria that are also really important for health.
The difference between the prebiotic, which is a type of fiber, and just fiber in general, is the selective utilization by identifiable strains of bacteria.
That's correct, Dan. That's part of the important definition about prebiotics, is that they have to be selectively utilized. And that's why fiber as a sort of generic term can't be a prebiotic, but certain specific fibers can be. So for example, beta-glucan is being investigated to try to determine whether that could be a prebiotic fiber, because it is utilized by some bacteria, not by all bacteria. So it does fit that selective utilization, which is one of the criteria of a prebiotic.
And I assume, Karen, that fiber can have other physiological effects. I mean, you'd imagine in things like constipation, fiber might have a positive effect. Is that, do you think, through the action of microbes on them, or do you think fiber can actually have just an effect in and of itself, disconnected from its role in helping microbes to grow?
I think there are studies showing that fiber has that dual effect. So just eating fiber that in itself, as you say, is very helpful to improve gut transit and help in constipation. And in that respect, that fiber certainly wouldn't be a prebiotic because it wouldn't be being selectively utilized by any members of the gut microbiota. Whereas other fibers may also have a beneficial effect in gut transit and improve constipation, but that they may also be used by the gut bacteria. So they can have two, the both effects are valid. And in fact, some of the health claims that have come out that are associated with prebiotics actually are linked to improving gut transit because that's quite a measurable thing. You can actually do a study and show that you've helped people who either were constipated before or may not even have known they were constipated, but you're improving their gut transit anyway. And the third part of the definition of prebiotics says that it has to have a measurable, well, it has to have an important health benefit that's measurable. So improving gut transit's almost like a sort of easy ask, if you want, in terms of adding the prebiotics. It may not be the most important effect that the prebiotic has, but it may be the one that's easiest to measure.
And if you had to identify, you know, a significant health benefit associated with prebiotics, what's the best example, do you think, in the scientific canon of people take this with prebiotic who have this condition or healthy people and they get this specific benefit?
That's a really tough question to answer very specifically without potentially offending lots of scientists who work on their favorite prebiotic. One of the good examples, which is, a fairly specific example as well, is that because prebiotics are metabolized by the gut microbiota, part of that metabolism changes the pH in the large intestine, and it tends to make the pH more acidic because it's producing fermentation acids, which are really important in themselves. But the actual pH lowering increases calcium absorption. So prebiotics have been shown to improve bone health, and that's through improved calcium absorption because of the change in the pH. And that's been shown in both adolescents and in menopausal women. So potentially that's a huge effect for during menopause and osteoporosis and, as I say, in adolescents as well. So for me, that's one really specific example, but it may not be the most important or the best one in terms of health outputs, but it's very important for those people who might benefit from it.
Can you tell us a little bit about how the prebiotics influence the bacteria, which then are able to produce products that circulate through the body and confer health?
The short-chain fatty acids, as well as the pH lowering that I just mentioned with the bone health thing. So the short-chain fatty acids themselves act on different receptors in the gut and then, as you say, have then knock-on effects elsewhere in the body. So prebiotics as a fiber, then they reach, when they're fermented in the large intestine, one of the bacterial species that ferments prebiotics is, and that's been widely researched and established, is bifidobacteria. Now, bifidobacteria, one of their main fermentation products is lactate. And lactate per se is not particularly beneficial for health. In fact, too much lactate is actually bad for health. But what happens in the large intestine, because you've got this mixed ecosystem, you get cross-feeding by other bacteria. So an increase in lactate production an increase in lactate production through supplementation of the prebiotic doesn't result in an overall increase in lactate because other bacteria use that lactate. And one of the really important routes of by which that lactate is converted by other bacteria into butyrate. You get a large number of lactate-utilizing bacteria that produce butyrate from lactate. And there's a lot of documented evidence for butyrate being important in terms of colonic health. It's a very important substrate just for growth and turnover of the gut epithelial cells. But it's also been shown to be protective against the development of colon cancer. So by using this sort of cross-feeding of the lactate means that the prebiotic can actually be beneficial in cancer prevention.
And for probiotics, Karen, we know that probiotics, of course, work in the gut, but they can also work, say, in the skin or maybe even your genital tract or maybe in the lungs or other areas of the body. Are prebiotics only aimed at the gut? Or can you imagine, or are there examples of prebiotics that would, say, promote the growth of beneficial skin bacteria or urogenital bacteria?
So, yeah, that's a great point as well. I mean, the traditionally, as you mentioned, the prebiotics have been targeted towards the large intestine. That's not to say that's what they have to be targeted against. I'm not aware of any particular examples elsewhere in the body, but I know that when we produced the consensus paper on the definition of the prebiotics, the most recent definition, we very deliberately didn't specify host gut bacteria because we wanted it to enable people to use prebiotics to stimulate the growth of bacteria. And we know that bacteria are really important elsewhere in the body, not just in the gut. And I think there will definitely be opportunities for prebiotics to be used to encourage the growth of bacteria that are shown to be important, say, in the vaginal tract, for example, to reduce incidence of bacterial vaginosis. Because if there is a way to reduce that through something slightly less disruptive on the microbiota than antibiotics, for example, then that can only be a good thing.
And is there any fear within the prebiotic community that a particular prebiotic could be administered with the best of intention to support the growth of bifidobacterium, for example, but it might inadvertently promote the growth of a bacterium that is not good for us? Clostridium difficile as just an example off the top of my head. But, you know, do you have to ensure almost that a prebiotic only supports the growth of good bacteria, which would be quite a challenge, I think?
Yeah, so that's another great point. So, I mean, that is part of the definition, if you want. The selective utilization is supposed to prevent, or is supposed to mean that a substance cannot be called a prebiotic if it supports the growth of everything. So, I mean, there are many substrates that support the growth of lots of different bacteria. And certainly they wouldn't be prebiotics because they're not having a health benefit. I think it's very difficult you can do pure culture experiments to confirm whether a substrate will enable a bacterium to grow or not. And what you have to always be aware of, though, is that pure culture experiments don't mimic what happens in the large intestine because it's a competitive ecosystem. So a bacterium that's able to use a substrate in pure culture, and that's a very valid result in that pure culture, but you can't then just say, so that bacterium can use it in competition, because it may not be true. It may never, ever be able to get there fast enough to use it when there's lots of other bacteria there that can use it. So I think that's probably one of the reasons why the activity of prebiotics should really be confirmed in that mixed ecosystem, because if you do pure culture work, you could get misleading results, because lots of bacteria, if they're forced to, will be able to use different substrates if that's all that's there, including Clostridioides difficile. It can use substrates if that's all there is because it's a survival mechanism. But if it has to actually compete with other bacteria who are experts at using that substrate, then it just wouldn't manage to do it.
My guess, the field has become so much more complex because, you know, in the past, I guess you could have fed a prebiotic or a fiber to a human or an animal, and then cultured or looked for an increase in bifidobacterium, let's say, in the colon, and that, you know, you could do that. Nowadays, you can sequence everything in the fecal sample. And so you might be looking at the impact of the prebiotic on literally hundreds or even thousands of individual bacterial species. So has that made the field better because the science is better, or just so complex that it's hard to draw a very firm conclusion?
So I would argue it's made it better because you have more opportunities, because you're not looking at an increase in one particular bacterium. So, I mean, yes, I've used bifidobacterium as an example, and a lot of the scientific literature sort of erroneously, if you want, states that prebiotics support the growth of bifidobacteria, because they don't have to support bifidobacteria. They can support other bacteria that are important for health. And I mean, when the first experiments were done looking at prebiotics, we didn't know about the rest of the bacteria. As I mean, you asked me this at the beginning, we just didn't really know what else was there 20 years ago. Now we know that there are other bacteria in the human gut that are just as important, if not more important than bifidobacteria, certainly in healthy adults. And you should remind me to go back to babies actually at some point, but certainly in healthy adults, there are other bacteria that are equally or more important than bifidobacteria. And some of those other bacteria are very able to use prebiotics. I mentioned before the crossfeeding example where by other bacteria that are butyrate producers use lactate produced by bifidobacteria. But some of those butyrate producers are also able to use the prebiotic substrates for growth directly. They don't need the lactate. They can actually use the inulin or the fructooligosaccharide or the galactooligosaccharide. And they do that very effectively and competitively. So there have been human studies, as you say, the ability to do sequence-based analysis of the results of any human intervention study enables you to see changes in these other bacterial species as well. And you would also be able to see whether pathogenic bacteria are increasing. Unfortunately, the studies haven't shown that so far.
Karen, I know you've done a lot of interesting studies, including in vitro. Are there any experimental platforms that you're particularly excited about, whether in humans or in animals or in glass?
Oof, that's a good question. There are. I mean, all these, there are new developments all the time that become very exciting to look at new things in lots more detail. So I think the ability to look at increased detail is really good. In fact, the Rowett's just got this new machine that I'm not actually really exactly sure of what its capabilities are going to be, but apparently you can look at the bacterial culture and fire a specific type of probe through it and identify compounds that are being produced by that bacterium. So potentially you could actually see which bacteria are producing specific compounds through growth on a specific substrate, and you can do that in situ as well. So it's a really powerful way of looking forward, and I think there could be a lot of opportunities to use that in prebiotic research if you want. I think one thing that you always have to be very aware of in any research area is that a model is a model, and it doesn't matter how good the model is, it's still just a model. And if you really want to show an impact, you have to show it in the host species that you want the impact to be in. So, and this is a very important thing for research in prebiotics as well, you can't extrapolate from one host to another necessarily. So a prebiotic that's important and good for a human might be important for a dog or a cat or a horse, but you would have to check it, that it does work in the same way there before you actually used it as a supplement for a dog or a horse or something.
And maybe in conclusion, Karen, and coming back to your earlier point, the role of prebiotics or human-made oligosaccharides, if you could explain to us what they are, in early life. I think that's one of the most compelling pieces of evidence that prebiotics are important to human health. Can you say something about that?
Yeah, so that's a really good point. So formula baby milk nowadays is actually often supplemented with prebiotics because there's so much evidence that's come out to show that specific types of oligosaccharides found naturally in mother's human milk are really important to enable the growth of specific bifidobacterial species in the infant gut that are really important for the baby's health. We know that the infant microbiota sort of co-develops with the infant immune system, and some of those bifidobacteria are really important primers of the immune system in the infant gut. And if the wrong bifidobacteria tend to establish, then it can affect the development of the immune system. So there's been a lot of research into human milk oligosaccharides. There's actually more than 200 different human milk oligosaccharides. So it's quite difficult for that to be mimicked in formula milk. So the best scenario, if it's feasible, is clearly human milk. But for instances where breastfeeding and use of human milk is not possible, then formula milk's now supplemented so that it contains some of those particular, or synthetic derivatives at least, of some of those particular oligosaccharides that would normally be found in the human milk. And I think that's been almost game changing, if you want, in terms of trying to improve the health of young infants. Because when you think back to, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, formula milk was derived, it's prepared from cow's milk. And the oligosaccharides found in cow's milk are quite different to those found in humans. And a calf doesn't have a similar intestinal setup as a human. We've already talked about that a little bit. So it's really important that we're now aware that formula milk should contain oligosaccharides that are based on those found in human milk.
I always found it compelling that the human milk oligosaccharides can't be directly used by the infant except through the gut bacteria. And that is really a compelling argument for why we have these, you know, the fact that the commensals and the humans co-evolved to promote each other's.
That's a great point, Dan. So yeah, those oligosaccharides in the human milk, as you say, they're not used by the baby. They're there specifically for, well, to promote growth of the bacteria in the infant intestine. So as you say, that symbiotic relationship between humans and the colonizing bacteria starts right at the very start and shows how important those bacteria are. I mean, there have been studies in the using what we call notobiotic animals, which have no microbiota associated with them. And I mean, some of those studies are really important to show mechanisms for lots of different scientific things. But the big feature about those notobiotic animals is that their immune system does not develop properly because they don't have any microbiota in there. So I think all of that together really does show that human milk oligosaccharides and other prebiotics in adults as well, if we're summing up in some sort of way, are really important to keep that microbiota that's so crucial for the health of the host. It keeps it established, it gives it growth substrates to function properly and keep that positive relationship going forward.
And I think it is a good place to finish up, Karen. And thank you so much for giving us your time and your expertise. If you could just finish with one last piece of advice. Somebody really wants to look after their gut microbiota, and I think you said it already earlier on. What kind of diet should they take to really do the best they can for their microbiomes?
So I think, your gut microbiome is a hugely diverse ecosystem. There are hundreds of different bacterial species in there. And the best way to keep all of those bacterial species happy is to eat a very diverse diet. I mean, some of my colleagues sort of describe it as eating a rainbow, if you want, but you have to eat lots of different foods, and the more different colors of food you have in there, the better, because it sort of encourages you to make sure you are eating lots of different things. And if you, for some reason, you know that you're in a situation when you can't eat lots of diverse things, then that's maybe when you should look into supplements and see, well, I'm not going to be eating X, Y, or Z, so therefore I'm going to take this supplement because that might help. Or if your gut microbiota has been depleted for some reason, then that might be a time to start thinking about specifically boosting up numbers of certain bacteria that you know are important.
And that's great advice. I'm coming from an institute that has 3 Nobel Prizes in human nutrition. I think we can take it as, you know, fact. Yes. Thanks again, Karen. We really appreciate you coming on.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.